morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Marthan Verbit, who is a pianist whose work is going to be performed this weekend, and also to Bill Burke White, our foreign correspondent. Right now, I'd like to welcome Stephen Tapscott. He is a professor of literature at MIT. He's a poet and translator of poetry, and he will be reading tonight, November 12th, at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, sponsored also by the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks.
It's great to have you here. You are a translator, and you translate from multiple languages, including Polish, Spanish, and what else?
Some German, some French. At the moment, I'm working on some Spanish poems and some Polish poems.
And the wonderful poet Wisława Szymborska.
Well done, well pronounced. I'm a great fan of Szymborska. She won the Nobel Prize about 10 years ago. In fact, I didn't speak Polish 10 years ago, but I started to read the translations of this poet who, she was a surprise choice that the Poles had won in the late 1980s. Polish poetry won the Nobel Prize for an austere, intellectual, brilliant male poet who lived in California. He was an exile. To everyone's surprise, except the Poles, 10 years later, Polish poetry won another Nobel Prize instead of the abstract, philosophical, elegant lyricism of the first winner. They gave the prize the second time to an 80-year-old woman who chain-smoked, lived in the neighborhood for 50 years, waited online to buy ham, you know, during the communist occupation. And I read these poems, and even in translation you could tell there's something going on there. There's a kind of intellectual friskiness and down-to-earthness that I just wanted to get in touch with.
I mean, she's an amazing... When she won the Nobel Prize, I bought a book of her poetry, and she's stunning. She's an incredible poet, and I don't speak a word of Polish.
The Poles love her because she tells the truth in a sort of down-to-earth, calm way. Let me read you this one. It's simple. I'm not going to... Better to give you the poem than to lecture. This is a it's a little elegy that she wrote when a friend's husband died. But she didn't want to be too emotional, but she sympathized with the friend what it feels like to be left alone. She wrote this poem called Cat in an Empty Apartment. Do you know this poem? It's from the point of view of a cat who has clearly been abandoned. But you know from knowing cats, a cat is too proud and too diffident to admit that something is wrong. So from the point of view of the cat, it's the person's fault for leaving, right? So this is a cat left alone in the apartment. Cat in an empty apartment. Wisława Szymborska. And what I loved about this is me interpreting, not the poem. What I loved about it is the tone. She gets the feeling of the cat right, and then it turns into an elegy. Cat in an empty apartment. To die? Well, you just don't do that to a cat. I mean, what's a cat to do in an empty apartment? Climb the walls? Rub up against the furniture? Nothing here seems changed, but everything has changed. Nothing's been moved, and yet there's more room here. And in the evening, the lamp isn't turned on. There are footsteps on the stairs, but they're not the same footsteps. No hand puts fish on the plate. Something here hasn't started at its usual time. Something here isn't happening as it should. Someone's been here and has been here and then has suddenly disappeared and now is stubbornly absent. All the closets have been ransacked. All the shelves have been run across. I ran under the carpet. Nothing there. That Capitol House rule has been broken. All the papers and books on the desk have been scattered. What else is there to do? Sleep? Wait? Oh, but just let him come back. Just let him show up. He'll find out. You don't do this to a cat. I'll walk towards him, pretending to be reluctant, slowly on highly offended paws, and no jumping up on his lap. No purring, at least not at first.
Stephen Tapscott reading the poetry of Wisława Szymborska. And you learned Polish for the sole purpose of translating this woman's poetry?
I did, and moved to Poland for a year, took lessons here, and moved to Poland for a year. I also want to read you a poem that has sort of shown me the limitations of translation. I'm here on a translation fellowship sponsored by the Witter Binner Foundation, God bless them, and at the San Francisco Art Institute, Diane Karp, the
Santa Fe Art Institute,
Gabe Gomez and Michelle Laplume Childs, the administrators. It's wonderful. It's a fellowship in poetry translation,
It's a wonderful fellowship, and it's an amazing thing to do because it's something that a lot of people don't think about is what's involved in translating poetry. But when you say the limits of translation, maybe read the poem and then let's talk about that.
I'll read you this poem. It's called The Sky.
By the same poet.
It's Wisława Szymborska. The word for sky in Polish is cielo. It's an adjective used substantively, and it means the blue, the way we say the wild blue yonder, meaning
cielo, it's the
same
big
as wide
Spanish.
Sky. Yeah. But it means the blue, the sky, the heavens, sky, heaven. It matters, however, whether you translate the poem as this is a poem about the sky, or this is a poem about heaven, or this is a poem about the heavens. You can't tell from the poem because she means all of them simultaneously.
Right.
And the English makes distinctions
right.
between the material sky and the transubstantiative, what do you call it? Transcendental heavens, right?
Right.
Here is the poem if you translate it as sky. Are you ready? It should have begun like this. The sky. A window without a sill or a frame or a pane. An opening and nothing more, but open wide. I need not wait for a clear night nor crane my neck to examine the sky. I have the sky at my back, at my hands, on my eyelids. The sky wraps me snugly and lifts me from below. Even the highest mountains are no nearer the sky than the deepest valley is. There's no more sky in one place than in another. A cloud is crushed by the sky as ruthlessly as a grave. A mole is as enraptured as a wing-fluttering owl. An object falling into a precipice falls from the sky into the sky. Granular, liquid, craggy, expanses of sky, crumbs of sky, puffs and snatches of sky. The sky is omnipresent, even in darkness under the skin. I eat the sky. I shit the sky. I'm a trap inside a trap, an inhabited inhabitant, a question and answer to a question. To divide the earth and the sky is not the correct way to consider this whole. But it merely allows survival under a more precise address, quicker to be found if I were to be looked up. My identifying marks are delight and despair. That's a materialist poem. The identifying marks are on your driver's license. They say, do you have any moles? Do you have any freckles? And she says, her identifying marks on her driver's license would be delight. She's characterized by delight and despair. Because of this material concept of the sky as everywhere. But what if you translated the poem as heaven, right? It turns into a whole different argument. It goes back to Genesis. Well, the first thing God does is divide the earth from the heavens. So is our whole metaphysics divided on this idea of separation of the material and the spiritual? What if we didn't believe that anymore? What if we believe that heaven is everywhere? Heaven saturates us. In that case, the poem sounds like this. It should have started like this. Heaven. A window without a sill or a frame or a pane. An opening and nothing more, but open wide. I don't need to wait for a clear night nor crane my neck to examine heaven. I have heaven at my back, at my hand, on my eyelids. Heaven wraps me snugly and lifts me up below, from below. Even the highest mountains are no nearer heaven than the deepest valleys are. There's no more heaven in one place than another. A sky is as crushed down by heaven as ruthlessly as a grave is. A mole is as enraptured as a wing-fluttering owl. An object falling into a precipice falls from heaven into heaven. The sky is heaven is omnipresent, even in darkness under the skin. I eat heaven. I shit heaven. I'm a trap inside a trap, an inhabited inhabitant, a question in answer to a question. To divide earth and heaven is not the right way to consider this whole, but it does permit survival under a more precise address, quicker to be found if I were to be looked up. My identifying marks are delight and despair.
Yes. Well, that brings up such an interesting question, is when you have such a rich language as English, where you have a different word for everything, when you have a word in another language that means multiple things, it makes your job very difficult.
That's the fun, isn't it? It's the pleasure of what's difficult. Also, translation works in both ways, because it permits us to see in another language things that we don't do in English, but that are... human truths or socially constructed emotions. Sometimes the grammar of another foreign language poem will teach you how to name a feeling that you already have but didn't know that you had.
Is there an example of that comes to mind?
I can read you a poem by Pablo Neruda.
Yes.
Which I did. I translated these poems that, this sounds like an advertisement here.
100 Love Sonnets. It's a facing page Spanish and English translation of Neruda's work, and it's a wonderful book. Feel free to... I will sing your praises if you don't.
It's a wonderful book in Spanish. Neruda met his wife, Matilde Narusha, when they were both in their late 50s. They were both single. And he just hemorrhaged these love poems for her, poem after poem after poem. And they're middle-aged and passionate love poems, which is a combination that in English we often don't know how to deal with that combination. It's they're adult love poems. We think of love poems as Romeo and Juliet and sort of effervescent. That's right, but you know, Shakespeare wrote Anthony and Cleopatra to follow up on what happens to the lovers. In the culture, we don't have a vocabulary for it, unembarrassedly expressing that sort of passion and affection for each other, or for thinking about human love as a basis for collective action. We get mildly embarrassed at those sort of arguments. What holds us together? We think we have to use religious vocabulary to describe affections that hold us together.
I mean, it does seem like one of the major differences between Latin American and Anglo-American culture is that exact difference that you described of our reluctance to use passionate love as a metaphor for just about anything bigger than itself.
It's one of the things that set of values is, to speak to your question, that set of values is one of the things that I think we learn from reading Latin American poets, for instance. I don't mean that as a cultural stereotype about Latino culture, but the literatures of Latin America have been much more forthright about talking about human affections and how individual human affections fit into our collective life together. Let me read you this one Neruda poem.
We're talking to poet and translator of poetry, Stephen Tapscott, and poetry of Pablo Neruda.
This is a poem number 11 from the 100 Love Sonnets, 100 Sonetos de Amor. There's one little footnote here. Quitratué is a nitrate mining part of northern Chile. Neruda actually ran for the national legislature in Chile, although he lived in the Isla Negra, which is a sort of plush suburb of the capital city. He ran as the senator from this starved and wild mining district up north. Kitratue, there are wild pumas and nitrate salts, and it's high desert, only poor. So this is Neruda at 60 with a woman who is slightly younger than he, but only by a couple of years. I crave your mouth, your voice, your hair. Silent and starving, I prowl through the streets. Bread does not nourish me. Dawn disrupts me. All day I hunt for the liquid measure of your footsteps. I hunger for your sleek laugh, for your hands the color of a savage harvest. I hunger for the pale stones of your fingernails. I want to eat your skin like an almond. I want to eat the sunbeam flaring in your lovely body, the sovereign nose of your arrogant face. I want to lick the fleeting shade of your eyelashes, and I pace around hungry, sniffing the twilight, hunting for you, for your hot heart, like a puma in the barrens of Kitratue.
Indeed.
He wrote, that's right. There's hope for us, isn't there, Michelle?
Never thought otherwise, but American youth culture does put a damper on people's image of what love and passion can be over the age of, what, a certain age.
Yeah, and it's no surprise to people who have survived their youth to discover that human love continues and, in fact, gets larger. And if you love other individuals, that affection permits you a sort of participation in a community of affections. People learn that, but we tend not to write about it. It's interesting to me that we have to go to, or that it's helpful to go to other cultures to learn that lesson and then bring it back home again.
It is interesting to contemplate what we know and express and what we know and don't express.
That's actually how I came to translate these poems. I was in one of those loops that writers get into. I was drinking coffee and staying up half the night and keeping watch after midnight, looking out my window and writing the poems of solitude and privileged romantic alienation, you know. they're good poems. I like them. But I also thought, Steve, it's time to be a grown-up. So I gave myself this assignment. I read these poems in Spanish. There are 100 of them, so that divides into 50 weeks, if you do 2 a week. On Monday, I memorized the poem. Tuesday, I did a draft. Wednesday, I finished the draft. Thursday, I memorized the poem. Friday, I did a draft.
So you memorized them before you translate them?
I did, because what I wanted to, during this year I wasn't allowed to write in my own journal, not to write any other poems. I could write responses to my students' papers. I love my students. They're good students at MIT. I could write responses to other students, to students' papers and, you know, emails, but no writing of my own. I wanted to learn how to write human affection. I wanted to feel the grammar, how one thing connects to another. There had to be some grammatical secret of what hooks things together. So I figured I'm going to submerge myself in this grammar to do it. I just did it as an exercise. But
So here's another poem by another, I guess, love sonnet by Pablo Neruda.
Yeah, give me 1 second here. Here's the last one. This is number 100. He imagines both of them gone, but still married and living under the earth somehow. She used to copy over his poems and typed for him and was his editor. So he imagines her still doing that, because even after in heaven or this sort of utopian afterlife, he's going to need a good editor. So she's his amanuensis. At the center of the earth, I will push aside the emeralds so that I can see you. You, my amanuensis, you, my editor, with a pen of water, copying the green sprigs of plants. What a world that will be. What deep parsley. What a ship we are sailing through the sweetness. And you and me, a topaz, There'll be no more dissensions in the bells. There won't be anything but all the fresh air, the scent of apples carried on the wind, succulent book of the woods. And there where the carnations breathe, we will begin to make ourselves a clothing, something to last through the eternity of a victorious kiss.
Stephen Tapscott, this might be a good transition into some of your own work. Would you like to read any of your own poems?
I'll read a poem. Sure. Thank you for asking. Sure. These are a couple of Valentines from a couple of years ago.
Did you write these before or after? No, you wrote them after you did the Neruda translation. The Neruda translation is sometime back.
I wrote them after the, although after all that story about submitting myself to learning the grammar of the poems, it took a couple of years for what I had learned from Neruda to catch up. Faith. Of course. Faith. Of course I believe in the soul. Did you think I had never loved anyone so strongly? I think rather it is the souls in the other life whose faith is tested, feeling themselves fade, the memories of the living turning from blood to milk, from milk to cloud. They stand at the corners of the room, the dead. They have learned to enter soundlessly, not calling attention to themselves. Why should they make trouble? They're even more themselves now than children are. Do we think they should stop being fallible and foolish only because they are completed? Dead is not an education. Dead is not a rapture. Did you think I had never been lifted? Dead is not a door. Afterwards is a lighted room where the dead stand around like guests at an awkward party, restless and longing towards some visible guest, handsome and laughing as though towards a silk window. Because he is not yet old enough to see them clearly, he sees, if anything, a fog-shaped fog in the corner. Did you think I had never been there? Attentives, seen through. I, who am only a voice to you now, speaking from one world into another, but we believe in one another. Of course we believe. I choose to. Did you think we had no choice? Let me do one more just because it's happier.
Okay.
Better place to end because this has been such a happy week. I'm really delighted to be here. It's a good positive end to what feels to me a good positive week for everybody, doesn't it?
I think a lot of people are pleased with what happened on Election Day.
And people are kinder to each other just already.
Do you think so?
It's remarkable. I really do. I really do. Don't you?
It's hard. I don't know how to... I don't know. I hope so.
It's a... been a long time since we've trusted each other in some way, or trusted that we were all in it together, or that the leaders are on the same team somehow.
Right.
Shakespeare invents his lover in this. This is a poem called Invention. Shakespeare invents his lover in the sonnets. The Psalms too postulate their God. Lover, why shouldn't I make you real? There is enough depletion, there is enough sadness to go around. I choose instead to celebrate the roundness of your absence. You aren't here. That suits me, and it turns me kinder, knowing that's what we have in common, the others and I. Each being twirling enclosed in time, each body longing for its other and singing recklessly.
Stephen Tapscott is a poet. He's a professor of literature at MIT. He's a translator of poetry. And unfortunately, it's time to go. I wish we could have another 2 hours reading and talking about this.
This is fun, Marisha.
But it's just delightful to have you on the air.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Stephen Tapscott will be reading tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thanks for being with us.
Bye.
We're going to take a little break right now. Actually, we're going to hear some of the music of our next guest. I'd like now to welcome pianist Marthanne Verbit. She has a new CD, which we're listening to a track from, titled Endangered, and she will be doing a solo piano recital to celebrate the release of the new CD, and that is coming up this Sunday, November 16th, at 3 in the afternoon at the Scottish Rite Temple here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Endangered. These are all pieces that address the environment and nature in one way or another.
Right. It is more about celebrating nature. I think we're all aware of the environmental crisis that's been going on, so I'm not trying to assume that I'm raising anybody's consciousness about that. But I think in the classical music world, there has not been a solo classical recording about nature, and certainly Bob Dylan and, you know, the folk song tradition was doing that a long time ago. So as far as I know, maybe somebody will let me know, it hasn't been done with classical music, which itself, well, maybe the piano is endangered. You know, the solo pianist.
Is the piano an endangered species?
More and more obscure.
I don't know about that. I speak for myself. So there's a number of composers on this disc, including John Kennedy, who is the artistic director of Santa Fe New Music, and a number of others. And some of these are going to be, some of the pieces that you're going to play are premieres and or brand new commissioned works.
That's right. John Kennedy's is a commissioned work. And it's a three-movement piece, lasts about 15 minutes, I would say. It's not easy. It covers the entire keyboard. It's called Naturali Periclitati.
What does that mean?
Which is Latin, he tells me, for endangered natures. I'm just going to believe him on that. imperiled natures.
And so you were behind the commissioning of all of these, of the various pieces.
Yes, and obviously I didn't commission all of them. The piece you were just playing at the beginning is by Peter Lieberson, and that was written before I ever had the idea of doing this, The Ocean That Has No West and No East. Then Hilary Tan, who is from upstate New York, is a professor of music at Union College. She had written, and I found, you know, doing research, that she had written a piece called Light from the Cliffs, which is remembering her first home in Wales. So Joe Fenimore, I commissioned. I've played a lot of his music over the years. I commissioned him, and he wrote this huge piece, which runs about 25 or 27 minutes. It's like a sonata. Four movements, and he named it Five Rivers, which is referring to, was inspired by the conservancy near Albany, New York, called Five Rivers.
So playing all this contemporary classical music seems to a non-musician like it would be a very different experience than playing, let's say, Beethoven or other classical composers.
The music is, you still approach it as music, but at the same time, playing new music, you're learning it from scratch. You're not playing your repertoire. The problem with playing new music is getting more than one performance of it. So with this recording, automatically I'm giving it more than one performance, and of course playing it for Santa Fe New Music, where the audience is already attuned to listening to new music.
That's a good point. I mean, we talked about this this past year during the Chamber Music Festival. When you have a premiere, it gets played once, and then it may never get played again. And when they co-commission, when two different chamber music festivals co-commission, then the piece gets heard at least two or three times.
That's right. So I thought, well, if I make a recording of it, and the record company latched onto the idea and liked it. I had recorded other discs with them. I mean, my last recording was 360 degrees the other way. It was Bad Boy of Music, and it was about machines and the urban landscape. So this was certainly not a rest for me, but it was another direction.
So tell us a little bit about your career as a pianist.
Oh, my goodness, that's long, long gone in the past. I used to say I have a brilliant future behind me, like Oscar Wilde once said. I played professionally for about 25 years and lots of places, blah, 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 you know, the usual thing. Started playing the piano at conception and all that. So it's all fairly familiar. Then I moved out here to Santa Fe and decided that I had played enough. I got numb from that routine of concertizing. And I had the luxury of moving here and living here and just continuing to play music when I had something together. I'm not out concertizing now, unless someone asks me, of course.
And you will be out concertizing this Sunday, the 16th of November at 3 o'clock. The new CD is called Endangered, Marthan Verbit on piano, and it's at the Scottish Rite Center. For more information, people can go to Santa Fe New Music, and they're at sfnm.org, or give a call at 474-6601. Marthan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now, and Bill Burke-White, our foreign correspondent, will be with us in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by phone, Bill Burke-White. He is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our foreign correspondent. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be with you, as always.
Great to have you back. So, this is a new era. We have now entered the era of Barack Obama, newly elected Democratic president. What is he inheriting in terms of foreign policy?
So I was absolutely thrilled on Tuesday night to watch Senator Obama become President-elect Obama, but I certainly would not have wanted to wake up on Wednesday morning in his shoes. I think he is inheriting what is the most difficult and challenging foreign policy environment we have perhaps ever seen, and certainly the most difficult one since World War II. If you look around the globe today, he has crises in more places than he can possibly deal with, and that is compounded by a very difficult domestic situation that will unfortunately have to take some level of priority as he starts to govern. So everywhere from Iraq and Afghanistan, where we have ongoing wars, to a more militant and hostile Russia, to a powerful China with a very difficult domestic situation economically there, to Latin America that has been largely neglected. As he looks around the world, it is a striking picture of urgent need, but also one where America may not have the finances and ability to solve many of those problems.
So what do you think, when you look at this, and you have been a student of foreign policy for a long time, are the most urgent priorities, and how would you and a team of people address those if you were in the new president's shoes?
Well, I think I would break it down in two ways. I would first ask what needs to be done in the first often they say 100 days, but in the very early moment of his administration. And many of those things will be perhaps more symbolic, but important, and then ask what are the deeper problems that need to be addressed during the first term. And in terms of the first sort of 100 days agenda, I would propose three things that I think are very important, are of relatively low cost politically and financially to the United States, but also send a very powerful signal to the world that we are in fact changing the way we are operating here. And those are first to announce, perhaps in the inaugural address or immediately thereafter, the closing of Guantanamo Bay. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Secondly, to announce a re-engagement with the International Criminal Court. And third, to announce a willingness on the part of the United States to take a serious role and a leadership role in climate change negotiations. First of those is closing Guantanamo. That is not easy. And one of the things we have to remember is the difficulty of doing some of these things. The problem in Guantanamo is that while there are some people who can simply be released, there are many people who you cannot just put on the streets of Santa Fe or New York City and say, you know, we're sorry. Some of those people need to be sent home to their countries of origin. The problem with that is many people will be tortured or mistreated in their home countries, and in other cases, the home countries won't take them. So you need to figure out what to do with those people. You might, for many of them, be able to put them through a normal domestic criminal trial in the United States. For some of them, they may have to go through special trials that will need to be designed to completely follow the rule of law and to be subject to judicial scrutiny, but still processes need to be developed. So I think we'll see an announcement, or I'd like to see an announcement that Guantanamo will close, but I don't think it will happen overnight. Secondly, we ought to announce a re-engagement with the International Criminal Court. Of course, Bill Clinton signed the Rome Statute, which established this important new court to bring to justice the perpetrators of the worst atrocities, but George Bush withdrew us from participation. And I think it's important that we send a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations saying that we still recognize that Bill Clinton signed the statute and sort of ignore the last 8 years. That doesn't make us a full member. We'd need the U.S. Senate to ratify the statute to be a full member of that court, and I don't think this Senate will have a vote of two-thirds majority in favor of doing so, but at least we could start cooperating with the court and voting for judges and so forth without subjecting the United States to the full jurisdiction of the court. And finally is to launch climate change negotiations. It's critically important. The environment is a world problem now, and one that we have shied away from dealing with and just ignored. Yes, there are problems with the Kyoto process, which has been the major form of dealing with climate change. For example, China and India aren't fully participating. But if the United States takes a meaningful leadership role, I think we can craft a climate change strategy that we are really in a leadership position for. So it's my hope that early on we could do those three things, send a very powerful signal to the rest of the world that we are changing our behavior and changing how we think of international law and foreign policy. So that's my suggestion for the initial 100 days. But you were right, Mary Charlotte, when you said that there are some deeper things that need to get addressed. And I think his first and foremost deeper priority has to be the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have now been committed in both of them. Things are thankfully improving in Iraq, but we need to make sure that the promised withdrawal of troops happens in a way that doesn't destabilize the country. You can talk to the military planners, and they tell you you can't simply pack up 120,000 troops on January 21st and send them home. It will be a more gradual process, and one in which many of those troops need to be moved to Afghanistan, a country that we went into right after 9/11 and is now in a perhaps worse situation than ever before. And it will take a larger footprint of the U.S. military to deal with the Taliban warlords, to deal with al-Qaeda that has now come back into Afghanistan. That doesn't mean an occupation like we saw in Iraq, but it does mean helping the very weak Afghan government rebuild and take charge in that country. So that's going to be number one long-term foreign policy problem for Obama, and it's certainly not an easy one.
Talking about Afghanistan, we had Sarah Chase on the air last week talking about Afghanistan. She is not only an observer of the country, but has lived there for quite a long time, and made the comment that Obama's proposed military policy there is not a good one, because the last thing they need is more war. What's your take on that?
Well, I should start by saying I have the greatest respect in the world for Sarah Chase and the work she has done there. And so I don't want to contradict her, because she knows Afghanistan far better than I do. As I see it, however, yes, we don't need more war in Afghanistan. But if you look at who's going to be governing Afghanistan at the moment, it's a collection of warlords who are really running the country based on revenue from opium and selling poppies, and a very weak central government with no meaningful ability to operate, and a resurgent Taliban in the border zones between Pakistan and Afghanistan. So on one hand, the last thing I want to suggest is more war. At the same time, I don't know if we can simply leave Afghanistan to run itself by a mix of warlords and Al-Qaeda operatives in the borderlands. So I think that the goal needs to be there, promoting the rule of the government in Kabul and helping them. And if the government in Kabul doesn't want American troops, there's not much we can or should do. But if they think it would be helpful to have a stronger military presence for a short period of time, then perhaps we ought to pursue that policy.
Let's talk about something which has been scrutinized a great deal on certainly alternative media, if not so much mainstream media, which is the power of military contractors, not only Blackwater, which has been talked about a great deal, but the many, many arms manufacturers who have a great deal of power and influence in Washington and whose interest it's in to keep conflict going so that they can continue to sell their products. Under an Obama administration, which is presumably less influenced by that group of people and more genuinely peace-seeking, what kind of conflicts do you foresee, if any, arising because of this what you might just call profit drive on the parts of the military contractors?
Well, one of the very refreshing changes that we are seeing is the Obama administration has made public that they will not be hiring registered lobbyists into the administration. That means that the lobbyists who have been working for many of those arms manufacturers won't be able to go into government and influence policy directly. So that's a breath of fresh air in many ways. The problem, though, is that the United States exports military equipment of all sorts, ranging from aircraft that are extremely expensive to tanks and down to things like guns and armored jackets and everything else. And American companies make a lot of money doing that. We recently signed an agreement in the civilian sector in the nuclear technology arena with India. That agreement stands to bring great profit and job creation to American companies that provide things like nuclear reactors and so forth. The danger is because we are in such a perilous economic time at the moment that if an arms deal would to go through to sell, say, 100 fighter jets some foreign country, that could be worth tens of billions of dollars to the American economy. And I think the hard questions will arise when President Obama is faced with a choice of ensuring thousands of jobs in some of those factories, whether it's run by Boeing or Northrop Grumman or any of the other large defense contractors, by selling military equipment overseas, or blocking those sales in a way that might promote peace and development elsewhere, but send more Americans to the unemployment line. And I think that will be a very hard choice and one where your morality is deeply conflicted. You might endanger the lives of people in India and Pakistan by selling them more arms, but you might also lead to greater economic hardship in America if you don't. And I don't know that there is an easy answer to that moral dilemma.
It's funny. It kind of reminds me of the a problem that you have in Afghanistan, which is you need alternatives. So if there is an alternative to manufacturing arms and people can be employed in other ways, that solves your problem. If there's an alternative to selling poppies and the opiates that you make out of poppies, as Sarah Chase is doing, and as there are small movements to replace the drug trade with other trades, then your problem is solved. And so that whole question of conversion and alternatives is one that I think we probably need to address.
Absolutely. It's the unfortunate problem in the United States right now is that because the entire economy is in such dire straits, there aren't obvious alternatives. And so clearly figuring out ways to build jobs in new sectors like the renewable energy sector and in more green technologies is going to be a long-term priority of the Obama administration. But that's not something that can be done overnight. So if you're faced with a choice of layoffs today or selling arms today, I think it's going to be one that will be hard to make the choice of not to go ahead with the sale. But we have to ask that whether those military contractors can develop meaningful businesses in other areas without, sacrificing huge job losses and without endangering the United States. So you do need a capability to manufacture aircraft. Perhaps at a place like Boeing, some of those people could be used in manufacturing civilian aircraft. But, of course, right now, there's not a lot of aircraft sales because the entire economy is in trouble. So it's a particularly hard moment to be faced with this choice of finding alternatives.
Where is the neoconservative foreign policy establishment at right now? I mean, are they doing some introspection and saying, gosh, we made a big, gigantic mess of the whole world? Or what are, I mean, they clearly won't have a much of a place in the Obama administration, but you know, are they still trying to further their agenda in one way or another?
Well, thankfully, they won't be in government, and I think they will not have a very important role over the next period of years, thankfully. But the entire Republican Party is going through a deep revisiting of what they're about and where they want to go from here. And I think the neoconservatives that are deeply neoconservative to the core, some of them still harbor the belief that what Bush did in Iraq and what is still going on in Afghanistan is the right thing to do, and that 20 years from now history will judge them very differently. I do think that many of them have woken up to the failure of their policy. But I think there's an important lesson even for the Democrats as they come into power here, which is that to some degree, the liberal internationalist agenda and the neoconservative agenda converge at a point. The neoconservatives want to change government to make way for democracy around the world and promote this vision of U.S. export of a kind of governance. The liberal internationalists also, in a sense, want to change those governments, and they want those governments to behave better and believe in a set of rights and liberties that other people ought to have. The difference is a question of methodology, and do you go and bomb them into changing their government, or do you somehow convince them in a different way? And I think the liberal internationalists, and I consider myself part of that group, have to look at what happened in the Bush administration and really think about the tools and the role of the United States. And I think it's very much a time that we start trying to lead by example rather than lead by force. And that's why I talked about things like closing Guantanamo, because that sets the right example. But leading by example is often harder than leading by force, and the new administration will have to remember that lesson.
Well, I mean, with great respect, it seems to me that the neoconservative agenda of exporting democracy was pure lip service. They never had any intention to do that, and when they had the opportunity to actually do it, they always passed it up.
I think, on one hand, in their theoretical position was, export democracy, turn Iraq into a democracy, and dominoes will fall around the region, and you'll have a happy democratic Middle East. Their problem, and theoretically that sounds like a fine idea, the problem is that you cannot actually do that. And I think at least the neocons sitting in academic institutions writing about their agenda probably did intend some form of democratization as a way of securing U.S. interests. But when they actually tried to do it, they suddenly found it either didn't work or couldn't be done, and that other issues got in the way and took priority. So I agree with you that their entire agenda was a failure, but I think that what they intended to do probably did look more like democratization than what they eventually did. And they made a fundamental error in understanding democracy, which is that you cannot simply have elections and think all will be well. democracy requires really building up a civil society and institutions within the country that can support democracy and make that work. And they just missed that in this rush to say, if we've had an election, we've been a success.
Bill Burke-White is professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. He is our foreign correspondent. Much more to talk about. We look forward to having you back on the air very soon. Thanks so much for being on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's always a pleasure, and have a good one.
You too. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz presents Artist of the Month, pianist Bill Mays. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.